From New York City, the epicenter of the pandemic, this is Democracy Now!
And it's just unbelievable, Amy, that they would want to film this. And, you know, it shocks the conscience. You just can't believe it, but it's real in 2020.
Authorities arrest a third white man for the killing of Ahmaud Arbery. This one charged with felony murder and criminal attempt to commit false imprisonment. We'll speak with civil rights attorney Ben Crump about how William Bryan filmed Arbery jogging down a narrow road in Brunswick, Georgia, in broad daylight before he was confronted by two armed white men, retired police officer Greg McMichael and his son Travis, who shot him three times. Then we go to India, which just saw its biggest spike in coronavirus cases in 24 hours, with 6,000 new reported infections as an estimated 3 million seek shelter from a powerful cyclone, and tens of thousands have no work or food.
Our employers threatened us when we went to ask for help. They said, do whatever you like, we don't care. Our families are really worried. They've been calling us over and over for days. We don't have any food or water here. On the contrary, we are being beaten when we ask for it.
We'll go to Mumbai to speak with Indian journalist P. Sinha, founder of People's Archive of Rural India. And as all 50 states are partially reopening this Memorial Day weekend, historian and author Mike Davis says reopening the economy will send us to hell. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Another 2.4 million Americans applied for unemployment last week as the coronavirus pandemic continues to push the country to its worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. More than 38.6 million Americans have sought unemployment benefits in the past 9 weeks, and economists warn over 40% of the jobs may never come back. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell has warned unemployment could reach a staggering 25% by the end of June. Despite this, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's rejecting calls to extend enhanced unemployment benefits, which are set to expire in July. Meanwhile, the number of homeowners who did not pay their mortgage jumped by 1.6 million in April, a new monthly record. And new data from the Census Bureau found nearly half of all American adults say they're a member of their household had lost unemployment, hadn't lost employment income since mid-March. But not all Americans have suffered. One new report found the wealth of the nation's billionaires has increased by $434 billion, or 15%, since the pandemic began. This is Chuck Collins of the Institute for Policy Studies.
Since March 18th, 38.5 million people have filed for unemployment. Over that same 2 months, billionaire wealth has surged. $434 billion in that short time. And we're seeing the billionaire class in the United States overall is seeing their wealth accelerate in the last couple months. Even Jeff Bezos and Mark Zuckerberg's wealth combined has gone up $60 billion since March 18th.
Fears are growing Latin America could become the new epicenter of the COVID-19 pandemic. In Brazil, the death toll has topped 20,000 after nearly 1,200 deaths were reported Thursday. It was the country's deadliest day to date. Mexico's also reported over 400 new COVID deaths and nearly 3,000 new coronavirus cases Thursday, both new single-day records. Cases are also rapidly rising in Peru and Chile. 60% of all new COVID cases are now in South America, Asia and Africa. India and Indonesia both reported new daily highs of coronavirus cases Thursday. China's reported a new coronavirus outbreak in the province of Jilin near the border of Russia and North Korea. And Singapore reported about 450 new cases, nearly all among migrants who live in crowded dorms built for foreign workers. Meanwhile, in the Middle East, the number of cases in Gaza doubled Thursday from 20 to 49, raising fears of a new outbreak. As coronavirus spreads across the global south, the new World Bank report estimates some 3 billion people still don't have access to clean water and soap to wash their hands, one of the most effective ways to prevent transmission of the coronavirus. Here in the United States, the death toll from the COVID-19 outbreak has topped 95,000. Flags will be flown at half staff over Memorial Day weekend to remember the lives lost to coronavirus. President Trump issued the order after Democratic leaders on Capitol Hill asked flags to be lowered on the day when the U.S. death toll tops 100,000. In Alabama, the capital city of Montgomery has been forced to divert COVID patients to Birmingham due to a shortage of intensive care beds. This comes just days after Republican Governor Kay Ivey opened much of Alabama. Meanwhile, in North Carolina, 570 chicken processing workers have tested positive at a single Tyson plant. President Trump toured a Ford manufacturing plant in Michigan that was repurposed to make personal protective equipment. Trump refused to wear a mask while speaking to the press inside the plant in defiance of an executive order from the state's governor and the plant's own rules. Trump said he wore one during a tour of a Ford plant, but took it off before speaking to reporters.
Well, I did wear, I had one on before. I wore one in this back area, but I didn't want to give the press the pleasure of seeing it.
Photos later emerged showing Trump wearing a mask during a tour of the plant. Trump's visit to Michigan came at a time when the state is facing three major crises. The COVID outbreak has killed more than 5,100 people in Michigan. The state's unemployment rate is at an all-time high of 22.7%, and more than 10,000 homes were evacuated in Midland, the home of Dow Chemical, after two dams breached earlier this week after heavy rainfall. The New York Times reports nursing homes with African American and Latino populations have been twice as likely to get hit by coronavirus outbreaks as predominantly white nursing homes. Overall, 34,000 residents and staff at long-term care facilities have died from COVID. That's about a third of the nation's overall death toll. Meanwhile, the Anti-Racist Research and Policy Center has helped launch a COVID racial data tracker to document how the pandemic is devastating communities of color. The site highlights how the pandemic has taken the lives of nearly 20,000 African Americans. While Black people account for 13% of the nation's population, they've accounted for 25% of the deaths during the pandemic. Ibram X. Kendi, who heads the Anti-Racist Center, said the tracker is needed because the federal government is failing to collect racial demographic data.
We felt it was necessary to build the most comprehensive data set available and make presentable for people to understand the racial disparities we're actually seeing all over this country. And hopefully people will use the tracker to recognize what communities are the most vulnerable in their states and ensure that those communities are our policy is changing, and those communities are receiving relief.
Following weeks of outcry, authorities in Georgia have arrested the man who filmed the killing of Ahmaud Arbery, a 25-year-old Black man who was chased down and shot to death by two white men February 23rd. William Bryan, who's white, was arrested on charges of felony murder and criminal attempt to commit false imprisonment. He filmed the disturbing video showing Arbery jogging down a narrow road in Brunswick, Georgia, in broad daylight before being ambushed. Retired police officer Gregory McMichael and his son Travis were both arrested and charged with murder and aggravated assault earlier this month. We'll have more on this story after headlines. The Trump administration's announced it'll withdraw from another major international arms control deal, the Open Skies Treaty, which the George H.W. Bush administration signed in 1992. The deal allows the United States, Russia, and 33 other countries to fly unarmed observation aircraft over the other's territory to help reduce the risk of war. Last year, Trump withdrew from the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty with Russia. On Thursday, Trump's arms control negotiator, Marshall Belinksley, criticized Russia and China and warned that the United States is prepared to outspend anyone in a new nuclear arms race.
Said the president's made clear that we have a tried and true practice here. We know how to win these races, and we know how to spend the adversary into oblivion. And if we have to, we will. But we sure would like to avoid it.
In news from Capitol Hill, 29 House Democrats are calling on Congress to reduce this year's military budget. In a letter they wrote, "We must remain focused on combating the coronavirus and not on increasing military spending that already outpaces the next 10 closest nations combined." The letter was organized by Congresswoman Barbara Lee of California and Mark Pocan of Wisconsin. More than 80 deaths have been reported in eastern India and Bangladesh after Cyclone Amphan battered the region, leaving millions of people without power, damaging crops and destroying thousands of homes. It was the strongest cyclone to hit the region in over two decades. The worst damage was reported in the eastern Indian state of West Bengal, where many lost their homes.
Due to yesterday's rain, my house was wrecked. A tree fell on it. Everything is destroyed. Where will we stay? We used to work in Odisha, but due to the lockdown, everything is closed. There is no work and no income. My husband works in Odisha, and he's stuck there and is unable to send us money. How will I build my home? I have used up the money my husband sent to build a mud wall. But what will I eat now?
China's most important political event of the year, the National People's Congress, has begun after a two-month delay due to the coronavirus outbreak. The Congress is expected to approve a new security law in Hong Kong that would reportedly criminalize, quote, foreign interference and secessionist activities and the subversion of state power, unquote. Opposition lawmakers in Hong Kong claim such a move would end the autonomy of the former British colony, which has been rocked by protests over the past year. Dennis Kwok is member of the Hong Kong Legislative Council.
I just want to say to the international community that this is the end of Hong Kong. This is the end of one country, two system. Make no mistake about it, that Beijing, the Central People's Government, has completely breached its promise to the Hong Kong people.
The international humanitarian aid organization Oxfam has announced it's laying off nearly 1,500 employees, a third of its staff, and withdrawing operations from 18 countries, including Afghanistan, Rwanda, Sierra Leone, and Haiti. Oxfam facing a funding shortage due to the pandemic. Donations to Oxfam also fell after news broke 2 years ago that Oxfam had covered up sexual abuse and misconduct allegations against staff working in Haiti during a 2011 post-earthquake relief effort. The Senate has confirmed John Ratcliffe to be the new director of national intelligence in a party-line vote. He'll become the fourth person to hold the job within the past year. Meanwhile, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee has advanced the nomination of right-wing filmmaker Michael Pack to head the U.S. Agency for Global Media, which operates various state-run media outlets, including Voice of America. Pack's worked closely with Steve Bannon, the former Trump advisor who once headed Breitbart News. In media news, The Atlantic is laying off 68 workers and freezing salaries, even though the magazine has reported record online traffic and a spike in subscriptions. Most of the layoffs will be in The Atlantic's live events division. And Food Not Bombs is marking its 40th anniversary this weekend. The worldwide all-volunteer movement recovers food that would otherwise be discarded and provides free vegan and vegetarian meals in over 1,000 cities in 65 countries. The movement began in 1980 to protest the U.S. military budget, poverty, and destruction of the environment. Food Not Bombs volunteers have been arrested dozens of times while attempting to feed the hungry. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Following weeks of outcry, authorities have arrested a third white man for the killing of Ahmaud Arbery, the 25-year-old black man who was chased down and shot to death February 23rd while on a jog on a Sunday in Georgia. William Bryan was arrested Thursday on charges of felony murder and criminal attempt to commit false imprisonment. He filmed the disturbing video showing Arbery jogging down a narrow road in Brunswick, Georgia, in broad daylight, before being confronted by two armed white men and shot three times. The three men walked free for months after Arbery's murder. But after the video went viral and sparked mass outrage, Arbery's attackers, retired police officer Greg McMichael and his son Travis, were both arrested and charged with murder and aggravated assault earlier this month. Lee Merritt, the Arbery family attorney, said the video shows Arbery was chased by the McMichaels in their car for over 4 minutes before they killed him. Gregory McMichael is a former Glynn County County police officer who also worked as a prosecutorial investigator. Advocates say McMichael's ties to law enforcement shielded him from immediate arrest for Arbery's killing, and the Georgia Bureau of Investigation has opened an investigation into Arbery's case for possible prosecutorial misconduct. Brunswick Judicial Circuit DA Jackie Johnson recused herself from the case because McMichael had worked in her office as an investigator. The Arbery case has passed through four district attorneys' offices. Ahmed Arbery was murdered after briefly entering a construction site. Texts uncovered over the weekend show a Glynn County police officer instructed the owner of the property to notify Greg McMichael if he noticed any trespassers. But surveillance video shows multiple people, a number of them white, entered the construction site to look around, but only Arbery was killed for the alleged trespassing. The homeowner, Larry English's attorney, has issued a statement that said, quote, "It now appears that this young man may have been coming onto the property for water," unquote. The U.S. Justice Department says it'll review the case to see if federal hate crime charges can be pursued, but such charges cannot be pursued by state authorities because Georgia is one of three southern states that has no hate crime law. For more, we go to Tallahassee, Florida, where we're joined by Ben Crump, civil rights attorney representing the family of Ahmed Arbery. He's the author of Open Season, Legalized Genocide of Colored People. Welcome back to Democracy Now! Ben, can you start off by talking about the significance of the arrest of this third person? Usually people who open their cell phone and start filming are hailed as the people who break a case. The film certainly provided the fodder for the arrest months after Ahmad was killed. But what about this man?
Well, as Ahmad Arbery's family and my co-counsels have maintained from the beginning, we believe that William Rowdy Bryan was part of this organized gang that was attempting, based on a premeditated plan, to confront and capture Ahmad Arbery as he jogged through that community that day. And the text message that was sent by police officer Robert Rash to the homeowner saying that if you see him again, don't call the police, call Gregory McMichaels. He's a former police officer. So we believe this was an organized mob that was planning on confronting Ahmad. So it is wholly appropriate that he was arrested and charged. When you look at what Gregory McMichaels said on day one, he said that Rowdy attempted to cut off the jogger as he was running. And then we visually see objective evidence. For 4 minutes, they chase Ahmad Arbery in that community as he tries to escape and run for his life. So Ahmad Arbery's family is very relieved because they have maintained they want everybody who was part of this lynch mob who executed their child to be arrested and held accountable.
So this arrest came just after the raiding of the home of McMichael. Him and his son are in jail right now. McMichael, again, a former investigator and Glynn County police officer. Is that right? And what do you understand they found in the house?
Well, they have not revealed the contents of what they found in the house. The Georgia Bureau of Investigations is set to have a press conference today at 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. They may divulge some of that information if they can. But we do know that they are looking, based on what the family has tried to demand for equal justice for their son, connections between each and every person who was part of this lynch mob, this organized effort that was premeditated. And so when you think about the charges of felony murder and criminal intent to commit false imprisonment, William Rowdy Bryan is guilty of those charges, much in the same way if you have young people who make a miscalculated, stupid decision to go into a convenience store with the intent to rob the store, and you have somebody sitting in the car, where if a person is killed who's working at that store, everybody is charged. The person inside who did the shooting is charged with murder, and the person who was aiding and abetting driving the car is charged with felony murder. So it's no different in this situation when you think about how they executed Ahmaud Arbery and each and everybody who played a part in aiding and abetting in this crime.
I want to go to Kevin Gaw, the attorney for William Roddy Bryan, speaking on Monday. He directed a message to you, Ben Crump, and S. Lee Merritt, saying you have put his client in danger.
I want to take a moment and speak directly to Benjamin Crump and S. Lee Merritt, two of the lawyers for the Arbery family. I'm not here tonight to argue with you about the evidence. I discreetly reached out previously through community leaders. I pleaded with you a week ago on national television. I do not know whether you have heard my pleas or whether you chose to ignore them, so I will try again. Mr. Bryan is not your enemy. My plea is this: please stop. Please stop doing and saying things that place the lives of Roddy and his family in danger. Whether you realize it or not, y'all have put a target on his back. He is unarmed and defenseless, a sitting duck. I understand your passion and your zeal for justice. But respectfully, the ends don't justify the means.
So that was before he was arrested. That was the attorney. Ben Crump, your response.
Certainly. You know, since he made this plea directly to me and my Omega brother, Lee Merritt, let me respond directly to him. Ahmaud Arbery was unarmed and defenseless when he was executed in broad daylight. And furthermore, since he says our calls for his client to be arrested somehow put his client in danger, we want him to know that the Arbery family is very relieved, and he can be very relieved because the rule of law has prevailed and that his client was arrested based on evidence and probable cause. And he has no fear to worry about his client being in danger because I am certain that he is safe in the Glenn County Jail. And our clients, the Arbery family, would wish for him to remain safe and stay in the Glenn County Jail for a long time as they continue to push for justice for their son, Ahmaud Arbery.
Ben Crump, the video keeps showing Ahmaud Arbery going into this construction site where a house is being built. But other video has been released that shows white people over and over again going into this construction site. You know, it's a house being built. It's completely open. A white couple, for example, that very day walking in, sort of touring around.
Yes, ma'am. And that underscores the point that this was never about any trespassing or burglary. This was always about profiling Ahmaud Arbery because of the color of his skin. And we are requesting and imploring the Federal Department of Justice to handle this matter as a hate crime. There can be a parallel prosecution with the state district attorney who's assigned to the case, as well as the Department of Justice under the Shepherd Hate Crime Act, because we believe Ahmaud Arbery was killed based on the color of his skin. He was lynched in 2020, and we have to send a message not only to his family and community, but to the entire world that America We are better than this.
Then, Crump, also, what about the Justice Department? The calls for them to open a hate crimes investigation into what happened. I mean, clearly, the two men, Greg McMichael and his son, Greg McMichael, former police officer, investigator, they walked free for months before the video got out. The question of the corruption within the Glynn County, the district attorney, all of that going. Well, now the question of where the Justice Department is.
Absolutely. We want the Justice Department to not only open a hate crime investigation, but we want them to look at the due process of law violations under the 14th Amendment involving everybody who was involved in this investigation, from the police officers who were first on the scene to the first DA, Jackie Johnson, who it is alleged told the police not to file charges in the case, to the second district attorney, Barnhill, who also said, like Jackie Johnson, he had a conflict of interest, but yet wrote a memorandum saying that he saw no probable cause to arrest this murderous father and son duo, and in essence put his thumb on the scales of justice in favor of the McMichaels. And the third prosecutor, who said when he looked at this video and he looked at all this evidence, the statements, said that he didn't feel he could arrest them, that he had to take it to a grand jury. And so the Glynn County Sheriff's Department, who leaked the video of Ahmaud Arbery from 3 years prior, we believe in an attempt to assassinate his character, as well as Robert Rash, the police officer who sent the text to the homeowner that condoned and encouraged this vigilante mob to capture and confront Ahmaud Arbery.
Sean King said yesterday classmates of Travis McMichael said he was the single most racist man they ever knew, and that when they heard he'd been involved in this, they were not shocked. But Ben Crump, I wanted to end with another case. You're also representing the family of Breonna Taylor, a 26-year-old aspiring nurse who was shot to death by police inside her own apartment. Her family's filed a wrongful death lawsuit against the Louisville Metro Police Department, the lawsuit detailing how police shot Taylor at least eight times after they burst into her apartment unannounced with a search warrant. The man police were looking for did not live in Taylor's apartment and was reportedly already detained by police when the officers arrived at Taylor's residence on the night of March 13th. At the time of her killing, Breonna Taylor had been working as an emergency medical technician treating COVID-19 patients. Your final words.
Yes, I agree with Senator Rand Paul that these dangerous no-knock warrants, I believe, are unconstitutional, but as Senator Rand Paul said, they should be abolished because it is foreseeable that innocent, law-abiding citizens will be hurt or killed. And Breonna Taylor is exhibit number one. And we cannot forget about Black women. As I have been proclaiming, if you ran with Maude in the Ahmaud Arbery case, then you need to stand for Bree. Because Breonna Taylor, life mattered. Black women lives matter too. And this was just an execution of her in the sanctity of her own home. And I look forward to coming back to talk with you more about developments in that case. The police chief resigned yesterday in the aftermath of this execution of this innocent Black woman. And we have to continue to demand that those police officers are arrested for the killing of this young lady who her co-workers and family and everybody who knew her said she was just an angel of a person.
Well, Benjamin Crump, we look forward to having you back. Ben Crump is a civil rights attorney representing the family of Ahmaud Arbery. He's the author of Open Season, Legalized Genocide of Colored People. Up next, we go to India, which is starting to loosen its nationwide lockdown, the largest in world history. It just saw its biggest spike in coronavirus infections in a day, with 6,000 new reported cases. Stay with us.
పిల్ల జల్లా ఇంటి కాడా ఎట్లా ఉండ్రో నా ముసలి తల్లి ఏమి పెట్టి సాధుతుందో, పూట పూట చేసుకొని బతికటోళ్ళం, పూట గడవ ఇంత దూరం వచ్చినోళ్ళం. దేశమేమో గొప్పదాయే, మా బతుకులేమో సిన్నవాయే, మాయదారి రోగమొచ్చి మా బతుకు మీద మన్ను పోసి, ఏమి బతుకు ఏమి బతుకు, చెడ్డ బతుకు చెడ్డ బతుకు చెడ్డ బతుకు చెడ్డ బతుకు చెడ్డ బతుకు. పేద రోగం కంటే పెద్ద రోగముందా, అయిన వాళ్ళ కంటే పెద్ద అండ ఉందా. కష్టకాలం ఇంటి కాడ ఉంటే సారు, కలిసిమెలిసి కలో గంజో తాగేటోళ్ళం. పిల్లగాళ్ళు కన్నులల్లా విడవకుండా మెదుల బట్టే, ఇంటి దాని దుఃఖమేమో ఆగకుండా తరమ బట్టే, ఏమి చేతూ ఏమి.
The Long March of the Lockdown Migrants, a song by composer, lyric writer and singer Adesh Ravi for the People's Archive of Rural India. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The quarantine report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn to India, which is starting to loosen its nationwide lockdown and just saw its biggest spike in coronavirus cases in 24 hours, with 6,000 new reported infections. India, a country of 1.3 billion people, has reported more than 118,000 confirmed cases, more than 3,500 deaths. This comes as the most powerful cyclone to strike eastern India and Bangladesh in over a decade killed at least 82 people this week, forced an estimated 3 million people to leave their homes to seek shelter. Meanwhile, a nationwide strike is underway today by many of India's trade unions against the suspension of labor laws. Since the lockdown began in March, tens of thousands of migrant workers have been left jobless, faced dangerous journeys to return home to smaller villages across India, most of them by foot. Hundreds have already lost their lives en route home. This is a migrant worker.
Our employers threatened us when we went to ask for help. They said, do whatever you like. We don't care. Our families are really worried. They've been calling us over and over for days. We don't have any food or water here. On the contrary, we are being beaten when we ask for it.
Well, for more, we go to Mumbai, India, where we're joined by the award-winning Indian journalist P. Sainath. He's the founder of People's Archive of Rural India, or PARI, which focuses on rural India, where more than 833 million people live, speaking 780 living languages. But first, I want to play part of an interview by PARI with 11-year-old Paras Madikar. After the lockdown, his father lost his job as a driver, and the boy began selling vegetables to help his family make money.
At 5:30 every morning, I go and get whatever vegetables I can find, and then I have to sell it. Those who want to buy, they buy it. Many people buy vegetables, many don't. I get very little time to study. I find little time in the morning. In the afternoon, after eating lunch, I again study for some time. I like going to school very much. My neck is hurting.
That's an interview by PARI, the People's Archive of Rural India. For more, we're joined by its founder, journalist P. Sainath. He's also author of Everybody Loves a Good Drought, Stories from India's Poorest Districts. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's so important to have you with us, Sainath. Such an honor. If you can talk, start off by talking about this boy and even the founding of your archive, the kind of journalism you're doing now. You are a well-known major journalist, mainstream journalist, but you felt that the people on the ground, the majority of India, were not being covered, their voices not heard.
Well, the average Indian national daily gives 0.67% of its front page for news of rural origin, where 69% of the population live. So obvious, there is not a single newspaper, not a single national newspaper, not a single TV channel that has a national level rural affairs editor or correspondent full time, nor is there a full time correspondent on the farming beat, nor is there a full time correspondent on the labor beat. So obviously, that gap is very huge, and we try filling it. But I'd like to answer your thing about the boy, Paras Madhikar. He was at school. He'd never been a child laborer before. When they shut down the school, his father lost his job. His mother lost her job. Amy, according to the Center for Monitoring Indian Economy, India lost 122 million jobs in the single month of April, okay, at an unemployment rate of 27.1%, now down to 24-25. 122 million jobs, and those were non-farm sector jobs, like his father, who was a watchman, in a chowkidar, a security guard in a building, like his mother, who was a cook in a canteen. All these jobs went. 91.3 million of those jobs, mind you, the 122 million jobs is three times what you've lost in the United States. Though 91.3 million were people who were small vendors, hawkers, tiny little, you know, stores, mom and pop stores, whatever. These are the ones that have got out. Many of those jobs are not coming back. Paras Madhikar, that boy, he is one of those children who was thrown onto the streets to earn something because his schools shut down and you don't get the midday meal anymore, right? But it's also very important for you to look at the large picture of what's happening to these migrants. And it's not just the migrants who are in trouble. You know, I think that COVID-19 has presented us, and I think much of the world, with a complete and total autopsy of the corpse of neoliberal policy of 28 years in India. Yeah, I think it's done the same elsewhere for other countries. We now know how fragile large sections of the population are after all the boasting about 8% growth and 9% growth and stuff. And how it also gives us a pretty good brain scan of neoliberal thinking. On last Sunday, the government of India passed an order. You saw that long march of the migrants, right? The government of India passed an order for a nationwide curfew between 7 p.m. and 7 a.m. You know what that does to the migrants on the highway, the millions of people on the highway? Yeah. It means that they can only now march hundreds, thousands. I mean, anywhere, they're marching anywhere between 300 and 1,000 miles, Amy. And these people now can only march between 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. in temperatures ranging, you know, in temperatures ranging from 103 to 110 degrees Fahrenheit. That's what the marchers are now, the people on the highways are now doing. Imagine that kind of thinking. Imagine the kind of thing, and that is neoliberal thinking. It makes rules to protect the beautiful people, and it has no thought for the marginalized. Look at how it's thinking on hunger. We have not in living memory seen this kind of immediate, urgent hunger on the streets as has been happening here. This country is sitting on what the government says is 77 million tons of surplus food grain. I don't use the word surplus. I think that's a fraud. But it has 77 million tons of buffer stock. You know what it's doing with that stock? It's given permission. The government has issued permission last month to convert large portions of rice, I don't know how many million tons, into ethanol so that you can create large quantities of hand sanitizer. Okay? You're destroying food grain to create hand sanitizer, which also involves large-scale use of water. Yeah? And of course, that ethanol will also go to blend petrol for fuel. I mean, this is the level of thinking when people are so hungry, when people are actually, you know, on the edge of starvation. We now know after 28 years of this path of development, how narrow is the distance, how minimal the distance between insecurity and hunger and hunger and starvation. The other thing they've done, what's the great thing that the states have done in response to this hunger and chaos and marches, we have reopened. You know what's one of the first things to reopen? Even before the so-called relaxation of the lockdown, thousands and thousands of liquor shops. Maybe, you know, we're being advised that you go on a liquid diet. I don't know. But you've opened thousands of liquor shops and the queues for those can be up to 2 kilometers, making a mockery of all the physical distancing stuff. But this is the way we are thinking. This is the way we are behaving. So it's really, I mean, you've lost 122 million jobs. People are terribly hungry. You have 77 million tons of grain piled up. And you're thinking of creating ethanol from it. So we really are, the migrants and others also, are in a terrible, terrible state. I also want to say that it's not just the migrants. Okay? See, we in the People's Archive of Rural India, we didn't discover labor migrants on March 26th after the lockdown like the rest of the corporate media did. We cover them 365 days a year. Okay? We know who they are. We know them personally. As you said when you were introducing the subject, that you know you got a guy to say that we are being beaten, we are running out of water, we are running out of food. Amy, those earlier when migrants walked, they did walk long distances even earlier to go home, they would have tea stalls, little bus stands and stuff along the way where they would stop, work for the evening, earn their way to the next 40, 50 kilometers, earn their way to the next 60 kilometers to the next bus stand where they would work in a tea stall. All those tea stalls and restaurants on the highway are now closed under the lockdown. So you're going to have a lot of deaths from non-COVID ailments, old Indian friends like diarrhea, dehydration, hunger, exhaustion. These sort of things are happening. When they, you know, let me give you one example. One example. The case of young Jamlo, a 12-year-old girl, indigenous person, who had gone with a party of people from her village, not her parents, but with others, to work in the chili fields, in the red chili fields of the neighboring state of Telangana. When the lockdown came and everyone was thrown off their jobs and their work, Jamlo walked 140 kilometers. A 12-year-old girl, she walked 140 kilometers in 3 days. I spent a hell of a lot of my time walking about the countryside. I've never done 140 kilometers in 3 days and nights. And she fell dead 60 kilometers from her home in exhaustion and from muscle fatigue. Okay, how many Jamlos have we now condemned the migrants to when we bring in a curfew that says you can only individuals, movement of individuals is strictly forbidden between 7 p.m. and 7 a.m. How many more Jamlos are we pushing over the edge? The entire process of what's going on is so utterly barbarous and, you know, shows what we have made of people. Do you know, let me tell you a little aside about the 77 million tons of food. Do you know how much that is, Amy, in the kind of bags we pack it? If economists like Jean Drees calculated 15 years ago, because we've had that surplus for more than 15, 20 years, that if the 77 million tons of food grain, if the sacks were laid in a row, you could reach the moon and back. Twice. It's twice the distance to the moon. So you could go and come back and you'd still have some more grain left over. Yeah. You could easily, if you chose, meet the people's hunger. You could do that. Now, but the food distribution system under neoliberalism has not functioned. The stocks have not functioned to keep prices low. They're functioning to keep prices up.
So
you have, yeah.
So please talk about what this means right now for India today. And also, if you can talk about the you can talk about the prejudice, the racism being expressed, trying to use the pandemic against Muslims in India and against Chinese Indians.
Yeah, well, it's not just Chinese Indians, but all people from the Northeast who look Chinese to, you know, so-called mainstream India. But two things have been happening. I do understand that there has been racism, that there has been sectarian propaganda in many parts of the world, not the least in the United States, where you had the great Kung Flu, right? But I do not believe anywhere else. It's at this level of communal sectarian prejudice where television channels don't cover the coronavirus, but cover said suspected Islamic conspiracies that planted it here, because there was an event by a small fundamentalist group, a religious gathering in Delhi, which turned out to be a super spreader. But there were many other events by other religions and other groups, etc. But this was an identified one. And there are millions of people receiving WhatsApp messages in multiple languages, telling them, how, you know, say, quoting a district judge, of course, a retired district judge who can't be traced. And there seem to be so many of them because they seem to be in all languages, about how this whole thing was planned by Islamic groups to devastate India, Hindu India. Okay, that's one. Second, fishermen in the East Coast. And I want to make this point to your audience, Amy. Today we are listening about the migrants. There are millions of relatives of those migrants back in the villages they're going. They are no less devastated. Yeah, the migrants are having it physically worse. But millions of livelihoods across the country were smashed by the way we organized and implemented our lockdown. Fishermen in the East Coast of Andhra Pradesh, my home state, they, you know, there is any way a fishing ban between April 15 and June 14 to conserve fish stock, because that's the breeding season for the fish. Now, that which means that the 2 weeks preceding that are the heaviest fishing period. Okay? Those couldn't happen because of the lockdown. And then when the poor fishermen steal out at 2 a.m., 3 a.m. in the morning at the risk of their lives and bring back a few fish to eat, they're not able to sell the rest. Either they sell it at one-fourth the price, or they're told by customers, hey, we've seen on WhatsApp that these fish are, you know, from the East, they're from China, and they're carrying the coronavirus. Okay? I mean, it is funny, but it is so bloody widely accepted.
Sainath, we only have a minute, and I wanted to go to your comment that COVID-19 presents us with a complete and thorough autopsy of 28 years of neoliberalism in India. Your final comment.
One, it's, as I said, it's shown us what these policies on food, it's like, for instance, for 35 years, we've all accepted, right, that healthcare is something to be bought, sold, traded, and that health insurance equals health. This is neoliberalism. We have a country where the maximum amount of the health system is in private hands. Where the maximum expenditure on health is from poor people, from their own pockets. That's one, on the health. On the education system, now, what happens? All the rich schools and the colleges and the private universities will switch to online education. What happens to the tens of millions of children? What happens to the tens of millions of children in government schools where you're lucky to have a decent blackboard? What happens to that? So the education system is smashed. This was also the pushing of so-called affordable private schools. All this stuff came with neoliberalism. So we've been smashed on the hunger front, on the education front, on the health front, and we now face a very serious crisis in the coming monsoon crop season. Because after 25 years, we promoted, like anything, cash crop for exports. If we repeat cash crops in the coming season, you're going to have starvation, right? Because worldwide, as you know, income and consumption growth have crashed. Nobody is going to have huge orders of sugar cane and cotton. That's not going to happen. Even the previous season stocks are piling up. We are desperate in People's Archive of Rural India, appealing to farmers, grow only food crop or you and your families are in very serious trouble. So that's with farmers and laborers. Each and every node of neoliberalism is now standing. Many of these things happened earlier, okay? They were not brought on by the coronavirus. They were brought on by conscious policy that this is how we should build a society. So these things existed earlier, but now we can't turn away from them. We can't pretend we don't see.
P. Sainath, we want to thank you so much for being with us, award-winning Indian journalist and founder of People's Archive of Rural India. We thank you for being there. We're going to link to your online website, and we hope to have you back very soon. The largest lockdown in world history is taking place right now in India. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, Mike Davis, stay with us.
All the leaves are brown, and the sky is gray. I went for a walk on a winter's day. I'd be saving more if I was in L.A.
California Dreaming by Bobby Womack here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. All 50 states will at least be partially reopened this Memorial Day weekend as the U.S. death toll from the COVID-19 outbreak will top 100,000, and some states prepare for a surge in cases. We're joined now by a guest who says reopening the economy will send us to hell. Mike Davis is writer, historian, author of a number of books, including Planet of Slums, City of Courts, and The Monster at Our Door, The Global Threat of Avian Flu. His new book is Set the Night on Fire, L.A. in the 60s. He's joining us from San Diego. Thanks so much for being with us and staying all night up to do this interview, Mike. Why don't you start off with that very provocative headline of your piece, Reopening the Economy Will Send Us All to Hell. Why?
I didn't choose the headline, but let me put it this way. I think a lot of listeners will remember the novel by William Styron called Sophie's Choice. The movie version, Meryl Streep, won the Academy Award for it. But in the story, a young mother, Sophie, arrives at Auschwitz with her two small children, and she begs the sadistic Nazi doctor to spare their lives. And he says, well, I'll spare one life, but you have to choose. Otherwise, I'll kill them both. Americans, tens of millions of Americans, have had to make that choice or will soon make a choice like that. The Washington Post poll of several weeks ago, where they polled people who were essential workers and have worked through the duration of the pandemic, and a third of them report that either they have a dangerous pre-existing condition or someone in their household has. So it is obscene and criminal that this choice, this impossible choice between income for people who have to meet their mortgages, people who are desperate to put food on the table, and to choose to work and, on the other hand, bring disease home to the people you love or to yourself. This is, of course, a totally artificial situation. Trump, of course, refused to use the Defense Production Act to compel the manufacture of protective masks and other gear, which other countries did with great success. Taiwan, for instance, turned over to the military the production of the mask, and in 3 weeks they increased production tenfold. But here, of course, we had to leave it to mad scramble to try and find private sector suppliers. Every hospital, every state, every city is competing with each other. But now he's used the Defense Production Act to force food processing workers back into plants where they work in the cold, long hours, literally shoulder to shoulder, and where the infection rates are almost as high as nursing homes and prisons. And why haven't the Democrats, why haven't we progressives, starting in March, have launched a national campaign about workplace safety and the rejection of this idea that ordinary people have to do a kind of self-triage to them and their families?
And yet at the same time, you have a massive corporations like Amazon, billionaires in this country who are making a massive killing now, a massive profit, increasing their wealth by some 15%, the latest report from Institute for Policy Studies, Mike.
Well, I mean, we thought we lived in one of the most unequal countries in history. But, of course, inequality will be far greater by the beginning of next year and next winter. Ordinary Americans went to bed one night and they woke up, looked out the door, and it was 1933. And the policies that are being pursued right now of forcing people back to work, of using the threat of removing unemployment insurance, or of even prosecuting people who don't go back to work because it's unsafe for unemployment fraud. The fact that in Texas, Iowa, Ohio, and states have put on these sites where employers can anonymously report workers who haven't appeared for work so that they'll know that their unemployment should be cut off. Public sector, local, state, county governments who, like the rest of us, actually live in the moment. The
Mike,
evidence.
We just have a minute in this part of the interview, and then we're continuing with part two. But you have said that global capitalism can no longer guarantee the survival of the human race. Elaborate on that in this last minute.
Okay. In four ways, it's become a threat to human survival. It can't guarantee food security or increase the output of food by the 50% the United Nations says is necessary to feed humanity 20 years from now. It no longer creates jobs or guarantees people income or a meaningful social role. It cannot decarbonize the economy or at the same time allow the poor countries, which didn't create the greenhouse gases, to make the great adaptations that are necessary for their survival. And finally, we're in the midst of a revolution in biological design, genomics. It cannot translate this biological revolution, the enormous potential that exists now, into public health, either in this country and, of course, even less around the world.
I want to thank you for being with us. Again, we're going to post immediately today part two of our interview with author and historian Mike Davis. His new book, Set the Night on Fire, L.A. in the 60s. We will continue with part two of our conversation, talking about socially distanced protests around the country. A very special happy birthday to Mike DeFilippo. That does it for our show. And a deep appreciation for all the team that works around the country working on this show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us. Stay safe.